One thing that the academic community learned much more recently is that the idea of intellectual property is also super important for small firms. It's not just a game that Microsoft and Google and Meta have to play. For technology startups, technology entrepreneurs, there are several studies now that show that the way in which you approach the intellectual property at the very beginning of your journey as a as an entrepreneur, as a startup founder, can make huge differences. It's much easier to get venture capital funds, much easier to get loans from banks, likelihood of survival, the likelihood of growing relatively fast and ending up, you know, being traded in the stock market goes up dramatically if the very first steps that you take in terms of protecting your products and your technology is done carefully.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we are thrilled to host Dr. Alberto Galasso, a renowned expert in the economics of innovation and strategic management. Alberto is a professor of strategic management at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, where he also holds the prestigious Anthony S. Bell Chair in New Technologies and Commercialization. His extensive research, which has significantly advanced our understanding of innovative activity, innovation management, and technology markets, is globally recognized. Alberto is a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research and a research fellow at the Center for Economic Policy Research. His editorial roles include co-editor for the Journal of Economics and Management Strategy, associate editor for the Journal of Industrial Economics and the International Journal of Industrial Organization, and editorial board member for the Strategic Management Journal. Author of The Management of Innovation, Dr. Galasso's work explores critical areas such as patent rights, licensing life-saving drugs for developing countries, and the impact of regulatory environments on innovation. His specialties include applied econometrics, applied game theory, and microeconomics. We are excited to have Alberto join us today to share his invaluable insights on fostering a thriving innovation ecosystem and navigating the complex landscape of technology commercialization. So, Alberto, welcome to the Innovation Insights podcast. I'm so thrilled to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a great pleasure to be here.
Well, and I want to let our guests, our audience, know how Alberto and I connected. Alberto is like my first TikTok friend. We connected via TikTok. He's the first person I could say that. Oh, I connected via TikTok. Networking can happen everywhere.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was also looking for other academics on TikTok. We are a very, very rare kind of group of users, but there is some very interesting content there if you look carefully, right?
There is. And I would have to say, I've been so impressed with your TikTok channel and your content. And one thing that we do at Innovation Insights is help academics with branding. And you have done such a fantastic job of branding yourself and your content. So I suggest everyone follow him on TikTok.
Thank you so much.
Well, can you share with us a little bit about your career and how did you gain a love for economics and then innovation and strategic management? Because they're all kind of three different areas, but you have combined them very well.
Yeah, so I grew up in a small village in north Italy, in the north of Italy, really in the middle of farmland. And I went to a smaller local university there for my undergrads. I studied economics. And I realized that I kind of like the the academic environment. I kind of like the idea of being, you know, I saw this professor and I was like, look, you can study and read, you know, as a career. That's not bad. But I had no clue, right, how to get into grad school or really how to become a professor. And I was lucky to discuss with a couple of those professor there that became my mentor. They made me understand what going through grad school and get a PhD meant. And also they encouraged me to go to study abroad, to say, look, if you just see only one type of academic community, you're probably going to not have a clear understanding of how really internationally people do research. So, you know, I was not that sure at that time, what should I do or not do? And then I said, okay, I was able to convince also my parents, said, let's try just with one year of master degree. You know, I did, and I went to do a master degree of 1 year in Belgium, just outside the Brussels. There is a university called a Université Catholique de Louvain. And it was a master specialized in economic, but especially with the most kind of theoretical aspect of economics, almost application of mathematics to economics and microeconomics. And I liked it. And then from there, I started applying to PhDs and I got into a PhD, the PhD program of the London School of Economics in England. So it's there where I did my kind of doctoral work. But I started really, my goal was to really write something very theoretical, like really at the intersection almost between mathematics, game theory, and economics. I had no idea about application of economics to innovation or management of technology and so on. And in fact, the first chapter of my thesis, the first part of my research was really a very abstract mathematical model. And at that time, my advisor told me, look, it's an interesting machinery that you put together. It was about modeling negotiation between one economic agent and multiple other economic agents. And he told me, why don't you try to look for some, you know, setting where you can really apply these things, or what kind of environments this thing can really give you insights. And I started reading, and then I realized that this model that I put together could really be mapped into a situation of which one owner of a technology could negotiate a license to multiple other users of the technology. So it was this idea that I essentially came up with a model of patent licensing without knowing that it was patent licensing. And there I started essentially reading about this, and I was lucky that in the same department, there was a professor, he's still there, a professor called Mark Shankerman, that is an expert in economics of innovation, that then became my co-advisor. And after my PhD, you know, a long-term co-author and collaborator in terms of research. So is that, you know, I really started as someone that wanted to do things that were really abstract, and ended up working on things that are much more applied. And then I got a job in a business school in which I really teach courses that are definitely not related to mathematics, but much more related to management of technology and innovation.
Well, what I love about your story is how interdisciplinary it is. And early in my career, I was always told, or academics were told, specialize, 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 don't focus just on one area. But you're really a true example of how integrating various disciplines into your work can help you create a substantive theory that it can be an umbrella across many different areas.
Yeah. Yeah, and innovation is one of these areas where by nature is a kind of interdisciplinary. You realize that in every environment there is some form of innovation. And I think, you know, young scholars sometimes don't fully understand that it's important probably to be specialized in the tools that you use. If you're really good at, for example, collecting data, or you're really good at running some statistical analysis or interviewing people, it's good to be really specialized in terms of tools. But then in terms of research question, it's also good to kind of try to use the same tools across, you know, a broader set of topics, and in particular to see whether you can use these tools in a way that let you have some kind of dialogue with people that are outside your small community, right?
That makes sense. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think about innovation and patents, and you know, oftentimes people are thinking about some type of new technology, and how do you go about that process and manage it too strategically? You know, just not like, oh, I'm creating something new and what do I do with it now?
Yeah, exactly.
So would you talk to about, you know, be that strategic part of innovation?
Yeah, so innovation, once you start studying the topic, you realize it's especially from the perspective of economics or management, it is a super, super important topic. If you're interested about what makes a company succeed or what make a company grow, but also outside the specific company, if you think about what makes an industry being more dynamic, what make a city, a region being, you know, growing from the perspective of the economics or even a national economy, innovation tend to be always one of the top two, three drivers. So one thing that I tend to kind of tell my students is very important when you think about innovation to distinguish between what is exciting from the technical perspective, from what is exciting in terms of, or what is important from the term of the business or the actual impact on society, right? You can have your engineers, your scientists, your product designers being really, really excited about some aspect, telling you, look, this product now is very different from anything else we've seen before. But it can also be that consumers really don't care about that, or that, you know, there is just no impact of that product on any other dimension of the society. So it, in a sense, to think about strategic use of innovation, first of all, you need to kind of understand the difference between the technical aspect of a new technology and the actual business and social impact of the technology. The second step that is something that I try to push, for example, in the book that I recently published, it relates to the idea that you want to think how to manage the technology that you own, in a sense of like, how can you claim that the technology is yours, how to make sure that you can prove that you own something. And then once you know that you have ownership, you have to decide what you want to share with other firms, what you don't want to share, and if you want to share how widely and what you can get in return.
Yeah, and so to unpack a little bit of what you said, I mean, I really appreciate you talking about the impact and talking about that with your students and making sure that, you know, whatever you're innovating has an impact and that's good. But then also the logistics of making sure that you, after you do innovate and come up with a product or a service or something that's, you know, intellectual property, that you know that it's yours, and being strategic about that.
No, yeah, if you look at the business literature, I would say up to the 80s and the 90s, this idea of intellectual property, of getting a patent over a new product or new technology, was considered something that business, especially big company, had to do. But it was more something like, I need to do it because I want all my books to be in order. I want to do it because somehow my legal department think is important. But things have changed in the past 20 years. There is a very nice quote by Bill Gates about 20 years ago, in which he told to a journalist, it's time to stop thinking about patents and intellectual property as just a problem for lawyers. This is really something that can make a huge difference for a company. It can be the key driver of competitive advantage. It can be the thing that make you, you know, gain a substantial advantage over your competitors and the other firms in your industry. And if you fast forward 20 years, Bill Gates was definitely right. Now the estimates are, if you look at the top 500, you know, S&P 500, the top companies in the American economy, like more than 75% of their value is not driven by assets that you can touch. It's not driven by their factories, their plant and equipment, machinery. Is really driven by intangible things and intellectual property, this idea that you can claim ownership on things that you have generated, on new knowledge that you have generated, is really a very important component of the value of the companies. And in terms of academics, in a sense, in the 80s and the 90s, the academic community knew that. Like, there were several studies in economics and management showing that companies with a big and especially well-structured patent portfolio, they were doing much better than companies without. But one thing that the academic community learned much more recently is that the idea of intellectual property is also super important for small firms. It's not just a game that Microsoft and Google and Meta have to play. For technology startups, technology entrepreneurs, there are several studies now that show that the way in which you approach the intellectual property at the very beginning of your journey as an entrepreneur, as a startup founder, can make huge differences. It's much easier to get venture capital funds, much easier to get loans from banks. The likelihood of survival, the likelihood of growing relatively fast and ending up, you know, being traded in the stock market, goes up dramatically if the very first steps that you take in terms of protecting your products and your technology is done carefully.
Oh, that is, thank you. That makes me think about two areas. One, for academics themselves, because at one point it was thought that, especially in academia, that patents were, you know, people in the hard sciences or, but, you know, I have mentored faculty to, you know, go for patents for some of their work that they've done in their research. But sometimes that's not a message. And what are your thoughts on that?
So academic, you know, academic patent is a tricky one. Like, in a sense, I there are, you know, cost and benefits there. Definitely what happened in the U.S. has been been seen to be really an important step forward. Now, when universities started owning IP and managing patent portfolio, you see a much stronger increase in innovation activity that is more targeted at commercialization and having real impact with companies and with the local economies in particular. On the other hand, I think it's also very important, probably what you're mentioning too, like that still these days, a lot of academics don't know exactly what is the intellectual property policy of their university. In Canada, I think the problem is even more severe than in US. In US is much more uniform, that is all universities tend to have their own technology transfer office and very similar policy in terms of the fact that the university is going to own a lot of intellectual property developed inside. In Canada, there are a lot of differences across university. In some university, actually, you know, the professor can still own the patent even if the research is done through the university, you know, with the labs of the university and so on. So it's there are definitely like a lot of benefits. One can also think, though, about the fact that this can, in a sense, shift research interest, right? If you have to choose between something that is a big question from a research perspective, but that doesn't really lead to intellectual property, compared to something that can actually generate IP and can be commercialized and give you monetary return, that nowadays we may have like a shift toward that, given that there is more importance to IP in the academic sector.
That's really good points, and thanks for sharing the differences between Canada and the United States. And it's something for faculty to think about, you know, the ownership, yep. The support that they do get from a university, the long-term benefits or constraints.
Exactly.
I do want to ask you too about, you know, and discuss small businesses, because you've talked about IP within small businesses, setting that up early on and thinking about that. And what I've noticed a lot, I watch a lot of YouTube videos.
Me too.
Solopreneurs and things like that. And there's a lot of talk I've noticed about IP, especially around artificial intelligence, AI, creating their own custom chat GPTs or agents. And you know, it seems like in the last month, this whole agent.
Yeah.
Customized chat GPTs have just been just completely exploding.
Right.
What are your thoughts about, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So no, my thought is like, it's fascinating, is that I think in the next 10 years, there is going to be some big change in the way we think about IP, and probably some big redesign of parts of intellectual property law internationally. It's always the case when you have some new technologies, there is always uncertainty about does intellectual property work or not? Can I really patent these things or not? But here is a very special, this AI revolution is a very special type of change, in which is really, the technology itself is really about accessing content, learning, and then creating your own content. So you have like the challenge from the IP strategy on both sides, like can this big learning models have access to all the information that is out there without violating IP? There is, for example, a big case between OpenAI and the New York Times about that. Is it, you know, the training of these models, like what are the implications in terms of intellectual property there? This is actually not about patents, it's about copyright. And my view is that copyright is going to be as important as patents in the next 10, 15 years, because this type of content that is created by AI is closer to what we typically protect with copyright than with patents, right? It is this idea of like writing a research paper, writing some kind of, or nowadays they do video, they do, so it's really there that there is going to be a need for more clarity and the development of strategies. So that's the thing that I think now is one of the things that I tell in my courses. In the past, you were learning about copyright and copyright strategy if you were in very specific industries, if you were you know, in book publishing, if you were in music, if you were in Hollywood producing movies, you had to learn about copyright. Nowadays, I think everybody in every industry need to have some basic of copyright. We, you know, every company, whatever you produce, they tend to interact now with the customer through websites. And you need to know what you own and what you don't own, or the information that you release there. Also, you need to, you know, a lot of this interaction that you have now takes place through apps. Apps are software that can also potentially be protected by copyright. And these things of artificial intelligence make the problem even more. Like, as we, across the economy, more and more people start using content that they don't generate, that their machine generates, then the question is who owns this content? And if that one is very important for your business, it's really important to think through about whether what you're using is something that you own or someone else can start blocking you from using it.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you for that answer and bringing up the importance of copyrights, because that's not something I'm hearing some of the big influencers or solopreneurs, entrepreneurs on the internet saying. They're talking a lot about IP and, oh, I'm creating this intellectual property. I created this app. I created this book, or I have this ebook, and this is my intellectual property. But I don't hear the word copyright coming out.
I think one of the reasons for that is that, especially in the US, there is a lot of litigation related to patents, but not a lot yet of litigation related to copyright. So in terms of like investors, and they're not so worried. But my expectation is that in the next few years, things are going to change because of these new AI models. There is going to be much more litigation and firms trying to block each other. And that is going to then lead much more attention to copyright and management of copyright.
Excellent. Excellent. But okay, so let's talk about your book. So really excited, about your book. And what inspired you to write the book? You kind of hinted at it with some of your previous research, but what inspired you to get this out there for us?
Yeah. So the book comes after a few years now of teaching courses related to management of innovation and technology strategy. By doing research in that area, I realized there were like a lot of research activity coming out, like, hundreds and hundreds of new academic articles every year across multiple disciplines. So across economics, sociology, management, geography, all sorts of new results out there. And not much material that try to kind of summarize these things. And if there were books that try to summarize these things, were books that were much more targeted toward academics. Here, what I try to do is to give a summary in a way that is at the level that potentially you can study this book as an MBA student, but even if you're not someone that is in a university, if you're a manager or an entrepreneur, they want to have a sense of what is taught these days in MBA courses related to innovation. I think the book provides a nice introduction to these topics and these ideas. And in particular, I also try to summarize things that you don't typically see in other books. So areas of research in which there has been quite a bit of work in the past decade, but have not yet reached the broader kind of management community in terms of like managers and other books that you can find in the market.
Well, kudos to you for taking such broad and deep information and consuming it and putting it together for us in a way that is really, really easy to understand. I love that you have like two main parts of the book, technology management and technology creation.
Yes. There you go. Yeah.
So let's start with technology management and your thoughts on that.
Yeah, there I essentially builds on the discussion that we had before. In that part, technology management, I say, okay, once you're engineers, scientists, or creators, like I like to think about innovation broadly. A lot of things that other scholars call creativity, in my view, is very close to innovation, if not innovation itself. And by the way, it's something that I really like about your content, that you have a very broad view of innovation, and I totally agree with your perspective. But the idea is that, in this first part, I start with this, like, okay, suppose you have something new created by your company. what do you do with that? And there, the big thing that I discuss is really intellectual property. I provide an overview of what are the type of intellectual properties out there. And then a summary, essentially, what do we know in terms of like, when should I use it? When should I not use intellectual property? And if I have it, how do I think about using the patents in terms of like stopping other firms compared to sharing the technology with other firms? What do we know in terms of the cost and benefits that as a manager you need to take into account if you have to decide whether to obtain or not intellectual property? And once you have the intellectual property, whether to share it or not? And if you have to share it, how much do I ask? Do I ask for royalties? Do I ask for fixed payment? What are the options available? And what do we know in terms of research to help us choose between these different options? So that's the type of questions that I try to address there. There is another aspect of IP that I discuss in the book, and I think is also something that is relatively not discussed enough. That is this idea that managers should use data in their decision making. Now, is a big statement that across all management program you typically see. The professors say you should follow data for your strategic decisions. And it makes sense. Like, you probably are gonna get a better decision if you have some data to look at compared to just using your intuition and your instinct without even looking at the data. But very often, students and people, which you tell them, they tell you, okay, well, what data do I use? Like, if I'm Microsoft or Amazon, I am a company that has tons of data. But what if I am a smaller company? What if I'm someone that doesn't have resources to pay people to collect data for me? Or if I'm a startup that I have nothing, I have just an idea, a prototype, I don't have resources to collect data and so on. And the point that I make in the book is that patent data are a very useful source of information. There are databases, and in the book I talk about the simplest one, that is Google Patents. It is a search engine by Google. It is exactly like this typical Google portal, but allows you to look for patents. And I provide some example of searches, and it's not, you know, is not the level that you would have if you are an expert in patents and want to apply for a patent agent, but it can be very useful information for a small company to do some search and understand who else has technologies that are similar to mine. You know, are there other firms? Are there a lot of firms that operate in this technology area? Are there few? What are the ones that are really closest to my area, those that are not? Are they big firm? Are there small firm? Are there national firm? Are they all, you know, abroad? Or, you know, where are the big presence of innovation activity in my area? Are they in China? Are they in Europe? Are they in US? So it provides a lot of very useful information for free, because these data are publicly available. It's also, you know, if you think it's about very complete and fairly carefully organized information. It's not that you ask to someone, you know, find other firms that sell similar products, and then it's a very subjective call. Someone can tell you this product is similar to yours or they're not. At least in the patent office, you have examiners that are expert that review all these things and can tell you, yes, this is really something new that we never seen before and is in this area or is not. And it's also very valuable information, because firms first patent and then sell. Like, so if you look at patent data today, if you track, for example, what your competitors are patenting this year, you have a sense of what they will sell 4 or 5 years from now. So it's really forward-looking information. So in a sense, it's like trying to help this idea of data-driven decision-making, pointing to sources of data that are really, they are free and are very detailed and very useful.
Oh my goodness, you dropped just like so many great nuggets for small innovators or small businesses. I mean, yeah, the Google, you know, search, amazing. And then, you know, after you get the information, you know, being able to use that to forecast or, you know, see what trends or what you know your competitors are doing. Oh my, yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Let's talk about technology creation and, you know, that part of your book and some of the core themes that, in that area.
Yeah, so that is that part of the book. It provides some summary of studies that came out. Some of them are really classical studies that I've inside that have been taught in schools for many years. Others are much more recent about what we know and we don't know of the things that can drive innovation in companies and in local economies. So I try to give an overview of factors. Some factors are inside the firm, like the type of people that you hire, the way you pay your employee, the culture in the company, and so on. What do we know about how these things matter for innovation? Others are outside the company. For example, if there is some big shock in your industry, there is a more or less competition. For example, there is a big price war between companies or some big merger that reduced the competition in the industry. How is that should affect the innovation activity that you expect in the industry? So there is a more kind of overview of this type of issues. And honestly, like when you study these things, you should, you know, at the end of the day, from all these studies, very rarely you have something that is very clear to tell you every time this happens, these other things happen. Every time competition goes up, innovation goes up. No, like I think the way I see these studies and in general academic literature is that it tells you very clearly, though, the cost and benefit, the potential channels that are going to play together. So, for example, if there is a big increase in competition in your industry, there are reasons why this should push for more innovation, but there are also reasons why for which this can push for less innovation. And the literature helps you understand the things to consider rather than telling you all the time there is going to be an increase or decrease in innovation activity. So I'll try essentially to highlight the trade-offs that innovators face and companies face and understanding how these things may matter.
Well, what are some of those trade-offs that...
Me tell you, like one that I discuss is, for example, what do we know about paying your scientists or engineers with a big bonus if they come up with new technologies that are patented, for example? There are very different views if you think about that from in the management world. There are people that say the creativity and innovation is not done because of financial returns. People that, you know, the less people think about financial return, the more likely it is that you have big creative ideas. But there are also cases of companies that did really well by giving bonuses to their engineers and scientists. Like one of the first one that experimented a lot with this was Motorola, the company that, you know, was at that time a leading company in mobile phones. They were giving all sorts of bonuses. If you were coming up with an idea that they could patent, they were giving you also non-monetary recognition, badges, and so on. And what the literature seemed to show is that essentially these things, you need to understand the cost and benefit of these things. So it's true that if you start giving bonuses to your scientists, if they end up with technology can be patented, you probably are going to have more patents in the next few years because they seem to work from that perspective. But it's also important to try to understand how they can backfire in the sense that if then a scientist has to choose between an ambitious project that may not lead to anything or 2-3 very minor projects that are likely to give you a patent, they're probably going to choose the one that they give, you know, the lead to the kind of, to the bonus or the return. There are also more problematic things. Like if you give bonuses for patents, then people are less likely, for example, to share idea or to collaborate because then they have to share the bonus. the likelihood of helping each other, the type of, they may be affect also in the term of like type of people that you can hire, people that are very good, but they're not happy to work in a very competitive environment. May tell you, I'm not happy to work in a company which there is all this competition for bonuses and so on. So there is a, you know, these are the type of thing that the positive and negative thing that came out from the study. So if you're in a company, you need to decide whether to implement some kind of payment system like that. You want to be aware of these things.
Well, and what I love, you know, what you're talking about and what you're describing to our audience here is really thinking about the human resources and how does innovation impact your human resources, which sometimes there's not a lot of discussions about that either.
Right, right. That's right. That's right.
Oh, that's great. So your book, it came out in what, September?
Yes, it came out in the summer of 2024.
Yeah. What has been some of the most surprising feedback that you've received about your book?
Look, I was really, really happy. I saw some very nice comments from colleagues. I was also very, very happy to receive some very nice emails from past students. People that, I taught many years ago that they saw the book and they still remember some of the content. So those are really nice reaction to see. And also, you know, I'm humble nowadays with the social media, as you see people talking about your book very far away. You see in Europe and in Asia, that is really nice, right? It's really nice.
Oh, well, as an academic, how was it for you to write a book? Because we hear about the, publish and perish, and oftentimes it's the focus on journal articles. And then sometimes later on in your career, you do write a book to help summarize those. You spoke a little bit about that, but how was it for you as an academic balancing writing a book?
Yeah, no, that's it was a kind of a special journey in the sense that it all started with lecture notes from my courses that then were built into a book. And actually, I think that is a very nice way to go. Like, if you think that you want to say something that can potentially also be taught in a course, to start with the designing a course around it and putting together material, and then also with the discussion with the students, you realize whether some aspects require a lot of discussions, others are very easy to communicate. So from that perspective, I saw it, in a sense. Yeah, it was a bit far away from my research. I had to take some time off from doing the more, traditional art research that leads to articles. But I saw it as fairly complementary with my teaching. I saw it as almost as an investment to make my courses more complete and more, and better for my students. So that.
How long did it take for you to write the book?
So it took about three years, but in conjunction with my teaching, so that I was working mostly when I was teaching and putting together the lecture notes. I wasn't at the submission to the publisher was done during COVID, so that one slowed down a bit the process of like going through all the external reviews and the. And the contrast with, but so that it took quite a bit. After writing the books, it took a while until I saw the actual copy, because really it was also during the COVID period that everything slowed down then.
Oh, kudos to you, because doing anything during the COVID period was not easy. Extra kudos. I do want to get your thoughts on this. Because now with AI technology, a lot of people are like, okay, let me just write my own book really quick. And let me just, throw a bunch of things into, Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini and just spit out an ebook. And and call it my new innovation. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, it goes back to my, I think we just see the beginning of this new technology, and I think it's going to be, the landscape is going to be very different 10 years from now. Like what does it mean to write a book? It may be very different. In a sense, this technology can help a lot. In a sense, as an author, you're still going to be on the driver's seat, because eventually you have to choose what is the content of your book. Even in the extreme scenario, which you don't write any word, there is still an important role in saying, I really don't think this part is a part that I want, and this part is not, and this is not done correctly, and so on. So in a sense, it may become much easier to write books. But then it may rethink the role of authors and being more like in really, the biggest book are not going to be very different probably in terms of style, but much more in the choice of content, in the choice of information, the choice of message that you want to have. So that is, but in general, I think this is going to be also super important in all sorts of other industry. Also in the music industry now, it's so easy to compose lyrics. It's so easy probably even to have like AI writing songs for you, and, same thing for movies and so on. So I think there is going to be a re-imagination of the role of the content creator. And I'm not yet sure, probably we have no idea what type of professions are going to be built around that.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Well, and I take from that someone should read their book before they... I read it and throw it up there. I've been experimenting with is writing, along with ChatGPT, lyrics for our company. And so we just have, a new song that we put out on Spotify about, love to innovate for Valentine's Day. And
amazing.
There's multiple versions of it. And, it's been fun. But yeah, you do have to have some input into that.
Yeah. And eventually even there, like you're going to have very easily 20, 30 lyrics generated by AI, and your role is going to be to choose the one that is, so we're, it's going to be more, much more work of a music executive than the role of the composer, right?
Yeah, it is. Well, and one thing that I do with, the transcripts from the podcast is I put them into ChatGPT and I ask for ideas for listicles and case studies, and I'm not smart enough to say, just give me 5, give me 20. And then I'm like overwhelmed with, all of the ideas. So like, what? Thinking about, future and aspiring innovators, young scholars and practitioners, what are your advice for individuals, especially when they're thinking about economics?
Yep.
And innovation and,
right.
And the future.
Yeah, no, I tend to tell students to look at these, at the programs or in general at content and courses that think about the management of technology, because, in a sense, especially in a period of intense technological revolution like the one that we're experiencing today, in which we really don't know what type of jobs are going to be there 10 years from now in a positive way, in the sense that I expect a lot of jobs that now we cannot even conceive they're going to be there. To think about the management of technology can give you skills that are broad. They can be used, you don't want to specialize too much in a very specific area of technology because you don't know how things are going to evolve. But content that is kind of broad, insights that you can use across industries, across technology type, are things that actually can help a lot in a period of uncertainty, which you don't know what industry are going to be really important and what industry are going to be less important in the future.
Oh, good advice. Good advice. I love the advice of, learning broadly, basically, and just exactly. Consuming information. There's a lot of information to consume. There's a lot.
Yeah. Now the problem is really not having information. It's like selecting, right? Information that there's so much content out there. And the question is like, what do I listen to, what I read, and what I don't? Yes.
Well, that leads me to, so how do you stay up to date on what's happening? Because like you said, there's so much information. What do you listen to? What do you not? How, where do you get your updates on innovation? And
So I have like the typical academic kind of, I go to conferences and I read articles, but then there is, I also consume quite a bit all these videos from places like YouTube or podcast, and there is really important to experiment, to try to listen to new things, but also to figure out those that you think can really convey some useful information and those that are not, like in terms of like asking yourself, are you just listening to something because it is just some good communicator, or there is really some good content there that allow you to learn something and to challenge your beliefs and so on. So for example, when I came across to your content, I really it really help me understand a bit more how broad, how a lot of the insights that we typically use for things that are very considered high tech, like life science innovation or computer science or engineering, in a sense can be used in all sorts of other industries that are much more creative sector, but there's still, there is the idea of coming out with new things, with new knowledge, and managing it.
Well, thank you. And I've been fortunate to have some amazing guests that are just fascinating innovators.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, one question that we asked our guests, all guests, is how do you define innovation?
Yeah, so in economics, on one hand, is that there is a very clear definition of innovation. It says, if you think about an economy in which there are consumers that consume products and firms that produce this product, if there are processes that change this in terms of generating introduction of new products, or that change the production process of firms that makes a firm able to sell the same product at a much lower cost, you call that innovation. So innovation essentially in the basic economic literature is the introduction of new products, or the introduction of machinery and techniques that make you produce the same products of before but a lower cost. Okay, this is these two type of, like, they're called product innovation and process innovation. That is kind of, on one end a very simple definition. The challenging thing is then to say what are product and what are processes. Okay, so what is really a new product? What do you define as a new product? And there is where I think you and I agree more than other people. And this is that for some, there are some experts that think innovation essentially is only what is, related to the engineering of a new kind of tool or the launch of a new pharmaceutical drugs. And, they're very restrictive view of what innovation is. On the other hand, people like me think, okay, in general, when you take knowledge and information, you recombine it to create some new content, some new information and knowledge, you have some sort of innovation. Not necessarily all the innovation out there is going to be with huge impact on businesses, on society. A lot of innovation is actually just some minor tweak of existing knowledge, some minor recombination of information. But is this process of taking knowledge and information that was never connected before and is connected now, that is what generated an improvement essentially in the things that we know that is at the heart of the innovation process.
Well, I am very partial to that definition because I do love interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary work. And, you know, you are such an example of that with your background in economics and innovation and strategy and management. And today you even touched on human resources, I really think for us as a society to answer big questions and complex questions and to really innovate, that you do need to draw upon various areas. And you're such a prime example of that. Well, thank you for being here today. And I will be bugging you and inviting you back, my TikTok friend.
Okay.
You may be very sorry someday that you're like, oh, you like that, video. You're like, oh, man, here's Yolanda again. She's bothering me for another podcast or some more information. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for it was a pleasure to join the podcast, and congratulations on the great content. It's a really nice podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And congratulations on your book. And I really suggest to our guests to grab it. You'll see more posts about this from us. And please just, think about innovation and the value and the impact that you're making with innovation. And then how do you be strategic and consider the economic principles of innovation as you're moving forward. And to our audience, please continue to follow us. And thank you for being here and listening to this conversation. Follow Dr. Galasso's work and get his book again, and subscribe to us and leave us some comments and interact and let us know if you have any questions. Until next time, keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.